Without Steve here, we sung less, and I have a lot more time to teach. So I may. So if you guys start to look a little bored, I may let you go early. All right. Keep in mind, here's where we're at. All right, in chapter 45, remember Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. They know who he is now. They're instructed to go back and to get their dad and bring everybody to Egypt. That's the instructions that he gave them. So basically, that's where we're going to pick up tonight, is in him giving those instructions to them, telling them what to do. But we talked last week about, if you remember, the way it all played out, and the fact that when he revealed himself to them, of course, there was some fear that came upon him, because here he is, a man of great power. They remember what they did to him. All right, it's no secret. They know that he knows what they did to him. So, you know, they're perplexed as to now what's he going to do. But Joseph, again, shows that incredible spirit of God, in that he, you know, not only forgives them, but he lets them know, listen, this is all part of God's plan. And he understood that. He had a great understanding and great wisdom when it came to such things as that. By the way, there's a couple of guys in the Old Testament that had incredible wisdom, incredible understanding in that regard. The first one you really see that more than any other is in the case of Joseph. I mean, we see, you know, we understand who Abraham is, and I know how God used him, and I get all of that, but Abraham made tons and tons of mistakes. You know, we can talk about Isaac and Jacob, but man, Joseph is a guy that comes along that just really exercises great, great understanding and great wisdom since the flood. And so it's just an incredible thing that we find in his life. But then you also look ahead, and you also just see a lot of this same picture with Daniel, because you see in the life of Daniel how he exercised incredible wisdom and understanding of God's will, and wouldn't back down from God's plan for anything. And regardless of what took place, he always stood fast. So what we saw in Joseph, and what we continue to see in Joseph, is a man that's committed unto God's plan. And he, even in a situation where, you know, it wasn't always an easy path for him, and a lot of times where I'm sure he, you know, he didn't understand the situation and why things were happening the way they did, when it comes right down to this, once he's where he needs to be and he sees God's plan having been fulfilled, he's able to look at his brothers and say, hey, listen, I'm not angry with you guys. This is a part of God's plan, all right? And then we had the long discussion last week about sovereign will versus permissive will, if you remember all that discussion. And both of those play out in this. And we see both of those taking place. But understand and know, God's will, his sovereign will, is sure. And so when we look at the things that he has, you know, given us in Scripture, for example, we know that there is nothing we can do to deter what's going to take place that we read about, you know, in Revelation. Nothing's going to deter those things. That's God's sovereign will. But he allows things to take place in our lives and make decisions and that kind of thing. It gives us the free will to make those decisions, but he never lets them get in the way of his sovereign will. All right, all things work together for good to those who love God. All right. So that's where we see this, and that's what we're looking at. Now, Joseph, in this particular instance, though, let me say this. He has the advantage of being on the upside of all of this. You know, sometimes we don't always get the privilege of being able to see why things take place in our life. You know, sometimes we just don't get that. Sometimes things will happen and things are going on. We can't understand it. We can't come to a conclusion. We can't, you know, reason it out. But, you know, when we look at those things and we think, I just don't get it. And we may die not getting it. I think we understand it when we go to be with the Lord, but we may die not understanding some of those things. But in certain cases and in certain situations, God gives us the, I call it a blessing, the ability to be able to see why these things happen in our life from time to time. And when he does, man, that is an incredible blessing. You know, and it's an incredible thing to know that you that God used you in his plan and used you in that way. Yeah. No, you know, when you get in talking about that, you know, we need never to lose sight that I don't, you know, we use the terminology win souls. We don't win anybody. We really don't. All we can do is tell them about Jesus. We lead people to the Lord, and then God convinces them of their sin and saves them. All right, all of it happens with God. He uses us as the tool, and we need to be an obedient tool. We need to go out and do the things that we do. And I believe every time we share that God gives them the ability to be saved. But regardless, we need never lose sight of that. And so, you know, a lot of that is what we see in there. Okay, verse 9. All right. When we pick up in verse 9, actually you get verses 9 through 13. They kind of talk about the same thing. Basically what happens in these verses is this. Joseph instructs his brothers to go get Jacob, all right, get Israel. That's where his name's been changed to, and their families, and to come to Egypt and dwell in the land of Goshen because the famine is going to last another 5 years, all right? So he lets them in on that, so now they know how long this is all going to go on. Up to this point, we talked about this several classes ago. They had no idea how long this famine's going to last. They don't know how much food to get. They don't know any of those things, but Joseph knows, all right? So now he reveals to them, listen, this famine's going to last another 5 years. You guys really need to get out of Canaan, come up here so that we can take care of you, all right? And so he instructs them to go back and get the family and bring them up, and they're going to dwell in the land of Goshen. Now, the land of Goshen is actually northeast of Egypt, and it's an interesting thing as to why they dwell in Goshen, and I think this is part of the deal even that apparently Joseph makes with Pharaoh, because Pharaoh's all for them coming up. That's not an issue. Yeah, this is your family. Bring them up. We'll take care of them. And in a moment, we'll see just how incredible Pharaoh really is in all of this. But the interesting thing is he doesn't say, bring them into the city and let them live here. He says, send them, let them live out there in Goshen. There's a couple of things that are playing out in this. You actually see it better in chapter 46, and we'll probably talk about it again then. But in going to Goshen, here's what happens. It keeps Israel separated from the Egyptians, number one, which is the key thing for God. All right? God wants his people to be separated. All right? Egypt is always a type of the world. But nonetheless, it keeps them separated from the people of Egypt so that they're out there on their own, and they're out there able to raise their families according to God's plan, so that they're not like Lot, who's looking upon Sodom for a while and then winds up moving into Sodom. You know, it's one of those situations where the families are out here to themselves so that they are not getting mixed in with Egypt and not just becoming a part of Egypt rather than their own people. God's design and God's desire is obviously that they become their own nation so that he could bless them and use them down the road. So from God's perspective, putting them in Goshen is the right thing. But here's how God uses that. It's an interesting thing because the Egyptians don't like shepherds. All right? So the Egyptians don't want them in Egypt. Let's put them out there in Goshen because, you know, the sheep are nasty in their estimation. Not only that, but the big thing is they're big into cattle. When we think of cattle, we think more in the terms of cows and things like that, you know. They're more into cattle. But sheep will eat the grass down to the nubs so the cows can't eat, you know. And so we don't like shepherds. So let's put them way out there. And it works to everybody's advantage because it gets them away from the people of Egypt who don't like them, don't want them anyway because they don't like shepherds. But at the same time, keeps them isolated, keeps them separated from the people of Israel, from the people of Egypt, so that they can grow their own nation and so that God can bless them out there and use them and keep them separated from Egypt. By the way, it's no wonder God calls us sheep. You know, when you think of it from that perspective, the world doesn't really care much for us either. You know? And quite frankly, they don't want us feeding from the same ground that they feed from, if you would. I mean, they either want us to compromise and become like them, or they don't even know that we exist or don't even want us to exist. And so, you know, from their perspective, the world's perspective, we're like Israel in this perspective. From God's perspective, he tells us pretty clearly, you know, that he wants us to be separated from the world. He doesn't want us, you know, to be with the world and to adopt the things of the world and become more and more like them. And, you know, he wants us to be separated from the world. And it's a shame because what we've found, this has happened more in the latter years than any other time, but our churches are becoming more and more and more like the world. We've incorporated things of the world into the church so much so that it's very difficult to even see how many churches are anything less than like the world, you know. And it's kind of interesting because you can get in the church, they can get for free what they have to pay for elsewhere. So they can pay for the nightclubs and watch the watch the great bands and watch the light shows and watch the the fire, what do they call it, pyrotechnics, watch all that, but they have to pay for all that. But now they can go to your churches that are along those lines and watch all the same stuff for free, and it's performed well. So, it has become an entertainment industry, the church has, which is sad. But you see, the problem is because the church has brought the world into the church. And God's design is for us to keep the world out of the church. That was his design for Israel, to keep the world out of Israel. But that didn't always work with them either. And we see over and over again to where they incorporated the things of the world. You see this, by the way, all the way through Scripture, do you not? We saw it prior to the flood. We talked about the sons of God, the daughters of men. What my beliefs are on that, regardless of what anybody else's are. They can be wrong if they want. But mine are, that the families of Cain and the families of Seth intermingled, and it just made for a populace of people that were not pleasing unto God because they abandoned him. And so, the problem was, had Seth's family stayed separated like they kind of needed to, that would not have been so much of an issue. But they did not. We see it with Israel over and over again. We can just name numerous occasions, hence the Samaritans, okay? We know that, what they are. It's intermingling with the rest of the world when he wanted them to be what they are. And so it's just a problem that's gone on and on and on. So, it's an issue. We saw it, if you remember, with Jacob and Esau. Remember Esau, he found him wives of the Canaanites when they said, don't do that. His dad said, no. And he did it anyway. He just did his own thing. So what we find is a common occurrence. It just goes on and on and on. So it's not something new. The concept isn't something new. It's an age-old problem. So what God did here is he used Goshen as a place to separate the people, Israel, from the Egyptians. Believe it or not, like he does with the church today, to separate us from the rest of the world. All right, another issue. All right, but nonetheless, so they go there. He tells them basically, listen, famine's going to last another 5 years. Come here, stay 5 years, and get past this famine. And 430 years later, they're still there. All right, but nonetheless, that's what takes place. Goshen, by the way, is kind of an interesting place because Goshen is a delta. Do you know what a delta is? A delta is like where rivers come in together, and where they're going to go out into the ocean, all right? And so all these rivers kind of come in together. Goshen is in like a delta area. Now, that's got its good and its bad. It's got its good because typically it would be fertile. Of course, they're in a time of famine, so that's neither here nor there at this point. But the bad is that very often it floods, all right? So, it has its good and it has its bad, but nonetheless, this is the land that they're to live in while they're there. And it's like, flat land shaped kind of like a triangle, as I said, kind of in between rivers. All right, with rivers kind of branching out at that place before it goes into the sea. And that's where they are. In verse 13, by the way, he instructs them to tell Jacob all that they had witnessed regarding his position in Egypt. Now, that may not sound like such a big deal, but it's a bigger deal than you think. Because he tells them, go back, tell Jacob that I'm alive, I'm here, and tell him about my position, tell him who I am, and then tell him all these instructions I've given you about moving here, all right? But the interesting thing is if they're going to tell him that Joseph is there, what does that mean they also have to do? Confess. Now, the Bible doesn't give us that, by the way. The Bible doesn't say they ever confessed that to him, but you have to assume that they did. I mean, we don't get every single solitary word that was spoken, but just the very fact that they told him that he was alive had to open some doors. They told him he was dead and brought him his coat full of blood. Yeah. So here they are, And not only that, but they're going to have to confess for two reasons. Number one, Joseph's alive now. We got to say something. Even if they can find another lie to cover that up, what a dangerous thing, because now they're going to bring Jacob to Egypt and he's going to be face to face with Joseph. What's Joseph going to say? All right. And then what is Joseph going to do to them for lying? You know, because they already passed the test with Benjamin, and now they don't want to mess up with this situation with Jacob. All right. So here we have it. They really have no other choice but to confess what they had done, because, you don't want any problems to fall into any of this. And so that's what's taking place. So in verses 16 through 20, Joseph and all of his family wind up getting Pharaoh's blessing. Now, keep in mind that Joseph, and this is something else we see about Joseph's integrity, because we see it over and over again, even though he has the power to do a lot of things, he never takes it upon himself to do these things without consulting Pharaoh and keeping Pharaoh in the loop. And so even with this, he goes to Pharaoh so that Pharaoh can offer his blessing and so that Pharaoh can understand and know what's going on and be in on it and not be a situation with, what's going on here? He makes sure that Pharaoh's always in on the whole situation. And so what they do is they get Pharaoh in on this. He tells Pharaoh, I'm going to bring my family from Canaan and I'm having to live out here in Goshen. Is that all right? And Pharaoh's like, yeah. I love you, love what you've done for us. Man, you've been the greatest blessing that Egypt's ever had. I would never want to do anything that would harm you or your family. Yes, I want to be a blessing to your family, bring them on. And he takes it another step further. He tells them this, he says, listen, do this. Tell them not to worry about bringing all their stuff. It's a hard enough road to travel. It's a hard enough journey to make. Tell them not to worry about bringing all their stuff, because when they get here, we'll give them everything they need. Whatever they need, we'll make sure they have it. So tell them not to load up all your chairs and tables, okay? Tell them leave that stuff there. When they get here, we'll take care of that. Not only that, but he says what they do bring, and just bring in their family and their flocks and all that kind of thing, all the things they have that are necessity, they're going to need a way to haul all that. He says, let me give you whatever they need to haul all that, wagons and carts and, whatever kind of animals you need and so forth and so on. Let me provide everything you need and make sure they got plenty of food for the trip. So Pharaoh jumps into this thing, whole hog. Pharaoh's like, because of you, I want to do this. Now, let me tell you what this is all about, because what we see in the life of Joseph is he has lived a life that keeps him at peace with the government, if you would. Are we not told, by the way, to live a life that keeps us at peace with our government even? I don't want to live a life that, I'm constantly in trouble, constantly battling somebody, constantly feuding with somebody. We need to live a life where we're respected by our neighbors, where people around us love us. We need to be, I'm going to tell you this, I always believed this. We need to be the very best employee that our workplace has. And we ought to have the very best attitude of anybody else in our workplace. And the reason for that is because they need to see in you something that really stands out. You need to have an impact. You need to be that go-to person for them anytime something comes up. I always thought it was kind of funny. I worked at Osborne Trucking for about 3 years when I was younger. And there was about three or four of us that were church people. I was the only Baptist. The others were Pentecostal. And they used to get upset with me, the Pentecostals did, because every time we got together, and I never made a big deal out of anything. I just tried to be who I was. And sometimes they'd go out and eat, and I refused to go with them because of where they went. And first one thing and another, and I always stayed real friendly with them and kept on good terms with them. But every time we had a meeting, our owner, who was, he called himself a Christian. Just stop at that, okay? But he always opened everything up in prayer. And he would always call on someone. And he always called on me. And these other guys are like, seriously? I mean, the one guy had been there a whole lot longer than me, quite a few years more than I had. The other two guys were hired on before I was there. And And every time they'd be like, seriously? Why does he always call on you? I don't know. I have no idea. It's not like I go in there and say, hey, listen, call on me. You know, I want to look good. You know, none of that ever happened. He's always calling on me. And always took, well, pride be a bad word there, but I always felt like, you know, that was an honor that he recognized in me something, you know. And I always thought that was so cool. And I felt bad for the other guys, sort of. But at the same time, you know, I thought, man, I'm glad that they recognize that. And it's good to feel like that they can see that in you. Joseph is one of those guys that made a point of being the best at what he did. If you remember, when his brothers, the second time, when his brothers came to see him, and he sent them to his house, you remember why? We talked about this just a little bit. You remember why? Because he didn't leave the job of distributing the things that had to be distributed until the end of the day. So he sends them to the house, tells his steward, he says, take care of them at the house, feed them, do all those kinds of things. And he basically tells them, I'll be there when the job's done. So he had a job to do. He didn't leave his job to go take care of that. That was something he did on his own time. He did his job. And after he did his job, he went back and did those things. It just says something about his integrity. It's no wonder Pharaoh could look at him and say, man, he's the guy. And I'll do anything for him. And I'll do anything to help him along. Because they really liked him. And thought he was a, you know, well, he was everything that God wanted him to be. All right? So it was important for these things to take place. And he was that kind of person. All right? Verses 21 through 25. As I said, they were given wagons, they were given pack animals to return for the journey, plenty of provisions for along the way. But Benjamin got a little extra treatment. He got a little extra special treatment, all right? He made sure that they understood that he really thought a lot of Benjamin. I mean, this was his full brother, and obviously he had never really even knew Benjamin. And so he really plays it up with Benjamin. And just to throw that in there, and I don't really, you know, the Bible doesn't really connect that. I'm sure there's some types and such in there. If you know some types, feel free to share them. But he just plays favorites with Benjamin. And the only thing that I'll be real honest with you that I can tie into that is I think about how much God plays favorites with us. Not me over you, but his children over the rest of the world, you know. And when you think about that, you know, what a type in that regard, how much God loves us. And you know, it amazes me at the blessings that God grants and God gives. And it just, I don't know, I just get overwhelmed sometimes because I think, you know, I'm not going to have enough money to do this or to do that, and God provides it. Or I'm not going to have enough, you know, of this or that. You know, maybe I don't have the abilities to do this or to do that, and God provides it. And it's just amazing at what takes place. And I think it's just kind of a picture that there's a favorite in that regard.
Well, look at a satellite picture of Israel and the surroundings.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's incredible.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, Israel's this big and everything else is this big, you know. Yeah. Yeah. And they prosper more than any of them. Yep.
And they work at it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they do. But they are God's chosen. You know, as a nation.
But they do work.
Yeah.
It wasn't like
absolutely. He's obviously a hard worker. I mean, obviously did his job. I mean, his brothers and all there, I mean, obviously he's anxious to meet them. He wants to go tell them that he knows who they are and this is who I am. And he wants to, you know, sit down with Benjamin. He wants to cry on the neck. He wants to do all that, but he's got a job to do first. And he gets his job done before he ever goes back and does all that. So that's kind of neat. All right, so all of this kind of takes place. And of course, you know, Joseph tells him not to get into any trouble along the way back. I find that interesting. When you look at verse 24, and just take a gander at that real quick. So he sent his brethren away, and they departed. And he said unto them, see that you fall not out by the way. Now, why would he tell them that? What is he saying? He's saying basically don't get in any mischief along the way. Don't do something crazy. All right, stay together. All right, don't do something dumb here, okay? Go back and do what you're told to do. You know, I think about this because even though he has kind of put them to the test, I would imagine he still knows who they are, you know. But bigger than that, here's what they have to face. They've got all these provisions. They've got all these things. We've got to go back and tell Dad that Joseph's still alive. Now, that means you got to confess, all right? And I wonder if Joseph wasn't a little bit leery that they'd back out on telling Dad the story. I don't know that. I'm just speculating here, okay, just so you know. I wonder if he felt like they might back out on that because, you know, here they are. They're going to have to go back and confess and say all the things they needed to say. And let's face it, they got all this stuff, you know. Not only that, though, but it could be just an innocent statement that here you are going back with all these provisions. You could get mugged along the way. I mean, after all, keep in mind, this is a time of famine. There are a lot of people out there that need stuff. Maybe it's just a matter of saying be careful because, you know, somebody might just steal all this from you, you know. Stay on guard. Watch out what you're doing. Stay together. Don't fall out. Don't fall out of the way one from another. Stay packed together so that you won't get in, you know, you won't have bandits stealing and killing and doing all the kind of things they could do. So it could be something along those lines. But in any case, he just tells them, listen, be careful along the way and, you know, and get there and get back safely. Our tendency. And you'll see them again. I can't tell you the number of times we've had people that'll, you know, come good and solid for a couple of months and get saved and following baptism. You never see them again. It's like, what happened? Where'd they go? And I can talk to them 1,000 times after that. Oh yeah. It's our church. We'll be there. Okay, love to have you, you know, but it's just, yeah, I hear you. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I guess it's a thought, you know. I mean, he is the brother. He's Joseph. So, I mean, he may have just been saying something along those lines. He doesn't strike me as the type, though, that seems to fall into that. Joseph, I mean, everything about Joseph shows like incredible integrity. So for him to be sarcastic doesn't seem to fit him, but I can't say that that's not the case, you know. Right. Was that sarcastic? I was just curious. All right. Verses 25 through 28, when they returned, they told Jacob that Joseph was alive, how he was the ruler of Egypt. Can you imagine Jacob in this situation? Okay, I'm thinking my son's dead. For 20 years, I've thought my son's dead, all right? And now you're coming back and telling me he's not dead, but he's the ruler of Egypt. He's the ruler of the whole world. I mean, keep in mind, Egypt was they were the nation. All that whole ancient world, I mean, literally was coming to Egypt to be fed. They were the rulers of the world. And the guy that was in charge of doing all of that is Joseph. So can you imagine Jacob here? So you're telling me, not only is my son alive, but he's the ruler of the world. I mean, come on now. Get a grip on this for a second. Because how many people do you think, how big do you think Israel is at this point? Any thoughts? You'll find out in chapter 46. But think about it. How big are they? I mean, when they come out of Exodus and they're heading toward Canaan, we could estimate a couple of million, right? 66. Yeah, 70, actually. Yeah, 70 people. That's how many people you're talking about. So keep in mind, we're not talking about, I know sometimes in our mind, we start thinking about this and we think, you know, probably thousands anyway, but it's not. We're talking, you know, 66, 70 people, all right? And actually, the exact number. It tells you the exact number. But I want to say it's 66 because there were 70, but Ur and Onan are dead, all right? This is of his lineage. It includes Joseph, which is already there. And it includes Joseph's sons, I think. I can't remember, Manasseh and Ephraim. They may not include those. I can't remember. But whatever the case. And then you have to add Jacob to the mix. I think it says 70, and then the next verse says 66. So that came with him. So that's the situation. So it's not like this big monster number. You'll see that when we get into chapter 46. All right? When we're looking at this, I mean, here he is in a family of 60, 70 people, and he's got a son that he thought was dead that's the ruler of the world. All right? It's like, seriously? Seriously. But doesn't this kind of bring to light, too, this whole concept where they knew who the Hebrews were? You know, isn't that amazing how God makes them known to the world? Remember, we talked about this several weeks ago, and he says they're the Hebrews, which is, you know, the pilgrims, the wanderers from up north, all right? And for them to recognize just so few people, it's kind of an amazing thing. Now, I will say this, it doesn't include whatever servants and that kind of thing that they may have, all right? That number is just family, all right? So they could very well have any number of servants and what have you. All right? So whatever the case may be, yeah. This whole thing, it was boils down to this. They went home, told Jacob, this is the deal, and now they're getting prepared to go to Egypt. All right? And we end 45 with all of this taking place. And like I said, they about had to have shared a confession in all of this, confessed their sin. It had to come out, you would think. And so they're on the way to Egypt now. All right? And that brings you to chapter 46. It's about 10 till. You want me to go ahead and highlight 46 for you real quick before we dismiss? We've got like 10 minutes. All right, let me go ahead. And I'll encourage you. We're going to hit 46 next week, so I would encourage you to go back and read it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, that is interesting because Egypt gives them, told them to go get them, gives them all the carts, gives them all the spoils. I mean, really, bring them in. But at the Exodus, when they take them out, they take it. They take it with them. They take the stuff from Egypt with them. It's kind of an interesting thing. You're right. Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that, but you're absolutely right about it. All right. Pick it up in verse 1 of chapter 46, and I'm only going to cover verse 1 because it gives us a pretty good introduction as to what's taking place. In verse 1, he says this, "And Israel," that's Jacob, just so you know, "and Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac." Beersheba's en route, sort of, close enough. And this is where Isaac lived, if you remember. And so he comes to Beersheba, and he stops there to offer up sacrifices. It's kind of interesting because both Abraham and Isaac had offered up sacrifices there. In fact, Abraham had built had planted a grove there. Now, I'm not going to get into all that, okay? We talked about that at that time. But he had planted a grove in Beersheba, and it was there that he worshiped God at that point. Isaac built an altar there and dug a well there and stayed there, all right? So it was home to him for a long time. And so what happened was he stopped there because this was a place that was very special to him. Now, keep in mind, he didn't have to go to Beersheba to offer up a sacrifice. He didn't have to go to Beersheba to worship. But it was the place that his fathers had set aside to do so. And so it was important to him to go by there. Keep in mind, too, that it was also there that God had reiterated the promises to Isaac that he had made before. And so this seemed like a right place to go, a good place to go for him to worship God and to confirm that he's doing the right thing going to Egypt. And so God does that at this place. At this place, we find out later in the chapter, God gives him confirmation. You're doing the right thing, and yes, you want to go to Egypt. This is all the right thing to do. So he gets that confirmation, that comfort. But I say all that to say this. When we look at these things, There are places probably in your life that are pretty special to you. I can pray anywhere. I mean, any of us can. We can pray anywhere, and my prayer at this spot or at that spot is the same effectiveness. But there is something about having that quiet spot and that quiet place that you just go to regularly that means something to you. It's your quiet place. It's your, you know, it's where you go. It's what you do. It might be that way with where you study. You may not go to the same place and study all the time, you know. Your daily devotions, you may have that quiet spot you like to go to. My dad often told a story of a preacher that he knew. He had, I think, I want to say in Georgia, but I wouldn't swear to that. Preacher, I think it was Preacher Ray. And he would go down there and hold revivals for him on occasion. And he lived in like a rural town and had a stream, a creek, whatever you want to call it, that ran through his property. And he always liked to go down by that creek and pray. He had a spot down there that he prayed. And when he would, he'd take a stone, just take a rock out of the creek and toss it over on a pile that he had. And Dad said, you know, that they were out talking and walking, you know how you do, and just and he says, well, you got that big pile of rocks there saved up for something, don't you? He said, no. And that's when he told my dad the story. And Dad said it just really meant something to him because he looked at that and thought, you know, what a reminder, you know, of how important it is to continue and to always go to the Lord and you know, and to refresh yourself in him and to pray and to talk to him. And he said oftentimes he'd think about that pile of rocks and how that meant something to that guy and, you know, knowing that he went to that place and being able to see all those prayers offered up unto God. There is something special sometimes about the place. We have a perfect example of that in our day and age. And it's a little bit confusing for people at times because when we talk about going to church, what we mean is coming to this building, do we not? But we all understand this is just a building. We're the church. Hilltop Baptist Church has nothing to do with 2425 Mack Road, okay? We are the church, all right? We are a local New Testament church. And it has nothing to do with the building. The building is the place we have set aside to worship and to meet. Yeah. And so what we do is we come here, and it's a place that we should be able to find comfort and encouragement. It ought to be a place where we find fellowship because we've chosen this place to unite together and this place to meet. And so it becomes something of that, you know. And I know, you know, a lot of people are far more comfortable going to the altar and praying, more so than maybe sitting in the car and praying. But the fact is, it's just a building that we have sanctified, let's call it, set apart, set aside for the work of God. But it is a building, and it's not the church. So it becomes a place that we're familiar with, that's important to us, like Beersheba would be to Jacob, all right? And so for him to go there, it was an important place for him. And so it was a place that probably also reminded him of times where God answered Isaac's prayer, where God answered Abraham's prayer. It might have reminded him of those things. And sometimes what we need is that reminder, you know. I know this is going to sound silly to you, and y'all might even laugh at me. The Bible I use to preach out of is a Bible that I've purchased over the years some point in time. I've worn out several Bibles, and this just happens to be the latest one. But the Bible that I read from every morning, that I just do my daily reading from, I do three chapters in the mornings. And I get done, you know, I just walk through the Bible. When I get done, I start over again, and I just keep doing it, is my dad's Bible. Now, that doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people. Now, my dad had a lot of Bibles. Don't get the idea. I got the exclusive one, okay? But it was my dad's Bible, and that means something to me. So when I read from it, and it's hard to read from. The print's not as big as I'd like for it to be. It's kind of hard to read from. The pages stick together. But I like reading from that one because I like holding it because I feel like my dad's held that there. And I can imagine my dad reading through it, and I can imagine him praying as he did. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of prayers answered, maybe holding this old Bible. And that means something to me. I would imagine that's much like Jacob here. God answered their prayers here at Beersheba, at this altar, at this place. I want to come here to confirm God's promises. It's a natural thing for any of us, is it not? Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's for remembrance.
Yeah.
Yep.
And this is a place of remembrance for him. And so that's important. Yeah.
See, the Jews still do that. When they go visit somebody's grave, they take a stone with it and put it on the top and you can see. No, sir, they do. I mean, and every time you go, that's what you do. You put a little stone there on top of the grave.
All righty, guys. That's all I got. All right, we'll pick up in verse 2, chapter 46 next week. All right, yeah.
One other thing is that anybody knows somebody that wants a job pretty many hours part-time, though, and the benefits, let me know. We're still looking at my work. They asked me about that.
Doing what?
Delivery. And we do the college work, so stages and stuff. And just go to customers and drop off stuff and pick it up and bring it back.
Well, if Judy wrestles with the bakery, she might be looking for something. Nah, God's gonna bless with that.
All
right. Let's stand, guys, and we'll be dismissed. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. In case I forget to tell you, boy, I tell you what, I just thank you for all the birthday gifts, the cards, and the Christmas cards and gifts and such. Y'all were very kind to us this year, and Debbie and I both just really, really appreciated that. Thank you so much for all you do. All right, let's dismiss. Father, thank you. We love you, Lord, and we just ask, Lord, your blessings on our work, on our church here. Lord, we just